make the most of your Walt Disney World vacation.
The top six Disney lessons you can apply to your life. Hi, I'm Herb Leibacher, and welcome to episode number 45 of The World of Walt podcast. Make the most of your Walt Disney World vacation for the week of November 1st, 2015. This is the podcast for Walt Disney World fans, whether you're planning your next trip or just enjoy reliving a little bit of Disney magic. Before we get into the topic for today, please hang on till the end of the show. I've got some information on how we can stay in touch and some important details on how you can win a great prize just for listening. It's said that it all started with a mouse, but we really know that it was started with the man behind the mouse, Walt Disney himself. Today, when we enter a Disney park, we're presented with a nearly perfect world, smiling cast members, well-maintained grounds, and food, merchandise, and attraction locations that almost always work flawlessly, at least by today's standards. And all of these Disney experiences that we enjoy were built over time with blood, sweat, and tears, and it wasn't always so easy. Walt had a storied life, but one with plenty of ups and downs, and we can learn a lot from looking at Walt's life and his company's experience in building theme parks, so let's do that. Today we're going to look at the top six Disney lessons you can apply to your life, and to help me explore this topic, I'd like to welcome someone who's a speaker, a coach, a brain tumor survivor, an author of the book, The Wisdom of Walt, Leadership Lessons from the Happiest Place on Earth, Success Strategies for Everyone, and a professor of a class called The History of Disneyland, offered at California Baptist University in Riverside, California, Jeff Barnes. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Herb.
So tell me, why were there no classes on Disney when I went to school? Because I think I probably would have signed up for one of those.
You know, that is a great question. Typically, I get one of two responses when people find out I teach a course on the history of Disneyland. Some folks wonder, really? Like that's what I'm spending my tuition dollars for my kid or my grandkid to go to college for? But then the other half are exactly like you or even like me. Where was that class when I was in school?
Yeah, it sounds much more interesting than geology or the music theory classes that I took.
I couldn't possibly agree with you more.
Good. So before we get into our top six list for today, tell me a little bit about your history with the Walt Disney Company.
Sure. Well, I actually grew up in the panhandle of Florida. I was a military brat. And so in 1974, our family took what was my very first trip to a Disney park, which of course then was Walt Disney World and the Magic Kingdom. And the very first time I stepped onto Main Street, I remember this vividly because I was 10 years old, I immediately knew that I was someplace very special, someplace very memorable, someplace very magical. And so I instantly became that kid throughout the rest of high school. If we were going to Disney World for any reason, whether it was a family trip, band trip, Boy Scouts, you name it, I was always the one most excited. I was the one counting down the days until we got to go back to Disney World. And interestingly enough, it wasn't until 1988 when I was a graduate student in the Bay Area of California that I had the very first opportunity to go to Disneyland. And to be honest with you, my first trip to Disneyland was a bit of a disaster. We got there way too late. We stood in what was then the very longest line for any attraction, which in 1988 was the brand new Star Tours. It was way too hot, way too crowded, and compared to the Florida version at that time, way too small, in my opinion. And so if you had told me that night that I was going to fall in love with the place to the point where I was going to teach a college course on the history of Disneyland, let alone write a book, I would have told you that you were absolutely crazy.
Interesting, the turns and twists that come with our life.
Well, I believe in living life like a story. Walt wanted to be remembered most as a storyteller. And of course, what makes stories interesting are those twists and those turns. And so what ended up happening was, a few years later, I was taking a group of young people back to Disneyland, and being the historian that I am, I realized I must have missed something. And so it was then that I began to do the reading and the research and just discovered, oh my goodness, this was the first theme park ever built. And Walt didn't just fall out of bed successful, and he had to fight all sorts of obstacles and all sorts of adversity to make his dream of Disneyland a reality. And once I learned that backstory, that's when I fell in love with the very first Disney park, which of course is Disneyland here in Southern California.
Great points. And actually, I wanted to mention that when I read your book, you know, every page or two, I would pick up something new that I never realized or see something from a different angle. And you just hit on two of the points. One is about storytelling, which I think is so critical to what Disney does and why it does things so well. And the other one is just this layers to the onion or layers of the cake. And you can keep pulling it back and pulling it back and getting more and more detail. And those, I think, are two things that really set Walt Disney the man and his company apart from a lot of other people who are in this business.
Yeah, I agree with you. Marty Sklar, who you know now is one of the Disney legends, you know, before he retired, he wrote his Imagineers that he had led for years and years and years and reminded them, we don't build rides. Other amusement parks build rides, but we build attractions. And what makes an attraction is that storytelling element. And it really is what sets Disneyland and Disney World apart. And, you know, Walt wanted to be remembered as a storyteller. He was accustomed to telling stories in the sound stages of Hollywood. And then ultimately, he wanted to create an outdoor environment where, you know, stories could be told and experienced by anyone and everyone. And he created a very immersive experience by, you know, building Disneyland and then just expanding on it by way of Disney World in Florida. And the key to all of that is of course, the details. Everything has to be congruent with whatever story that the Disney parks are trying to tell. One of my favorite stories from the book comes from one of the original Imagineers who was helping Walt build the very first completed attraction. And originally, the very first attractions were built at the Burbank Studio by a lot of the same individuals who had built the sets for some of the Disney movies. And the very first completed attraction at Disneyland was the old Disneyland Stagecoach. And for whatever reason, Walt was obsessed about these straps. He wanted them to be perfect. He wanted them to be something that the guests would notice. And the Imagineer who was working on it, John Hinch, he just couldn't get it right. And so finally he threw up his hands one day and said, Walt, why do you care? It's just a strap. Nobody is going to notice. And Walt stopped him right there and said, John, you're underestimating people. They are going to notice, and they will care. And as a result, they will return to the park again and again and again, looking for something that they have never noticed before.
Great story. And actually, your book is chock full of stories like that. And I'm excited that we get a chance to discuss that because, like I said, at each turn of the page, there was something new and interesting to discover. So anxious to get into that conversation. But before we do, we've got the infamous World of Walt warm-up question. It's easy. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Oswald the Lucky Rabbit or Mickey Mouse?
Well, I know it all started with a mouse, but I'm going to take Oswald.
Wow. Tell me about it.
Well, for me, Oswald is very symbolic, and here's why. Oswald was the very first truly successful Disney cartoon character, and of course, as we all know, he eventually lost control of Oswald. And it's on that train ride back when it seemed as if the entire studio would go under that Walt came up with and be the world's most successful cartoon character, and that, of course, is Mickey Mouse. And the lesson and the reminder every time I see Oswald is it's okay to fail. It is okay to stumble. And I actually write a little bit about Oswald in the chapter entitled Facing Fear and Failure. And the most fun part of that entire story is how for years and years and years, Oswald was lost to Universal. It was almost as if he were being held hostage. And then in 2006, NBC Television, which was then owned by Universal, had just gotten the rights to Sunday Night Football. and they coveted a broadcaster by the name of Al Michaels. And Al Michaels at the time was under contract with ABC. And of course, we all know that today ABC Television is owned by Disney. And so they ended up making a trade. Al Michaels is on NBC Sunday Night Football because Oswald finally came home to the Disney Corporation. And so it's a reminder, it's okay to fail. When you're pursuing your dream, you're going to have stumbles along the way. You just have to trust that it's all going to work out in the end. And today, Oswald is home.
Wow, good choice. I always wonder how Al Michaels must feel that he was traded for a rabbit.
I think it's a fascinating story. And if I were Al Michaels, not that he needs any material, but if I were at a party, that's what I'd open up with.
Yeah, it's really hard to beat that story, isn't it? Not too many people are going to have a better one than that. All right, good. Well, let's get into our topic for today, the top six Disney lessons you can apply to your life. And Jeff, as the guest co-host, we're over to you for number one.
Well, I think the first lesson, and we learn it from Walt himself, is that you need to be confident both in yourself and in your dream. Walt was a dreamer. He lived his entire life chasing his dreams. In fact, he would go on to say that when it comes to success, it really comes down to four C's. And those four C's for Walt Disney are: you need to stay curious, you need to have confidence, you need to have courage, and you need to make sure that you're always consistent. But then Walt would go on to say, out of those four C's, it is confidence that is most important. It is confidence that is most significant. I think for a lot of people, we're under the misperception that, you know, well, I need to have some success and then I'll be confident. But it really works the other way around. We have to be confident in who we are. We have to be confident in our dream, confident in our vision, and it is success that follows confidence rather than the other way around.
That is a great point, and it's interesting to think about the order of those things. So I think you make a really good point, which is many people will say, well, after I'm successful, then I will have that confidence. But you need to be confident in yourself so that you can make those things come true or work on them coming true.
Absolutely. And, you know, Walt had confidence that he was going to be able to come up with another successful character after Oswald the Rabbit. I mean, if that had happened to me, I would be texting my shrink. I'd be calling up my lawyer. Walt didn't do that. He simply got busy on whatever his next project was. When it came to the first full-length animated feature, which of course was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, he was confident enough to pour as much money as possible into that dream because he wanted it to be the best product possible. And then, of course, when it comes to the dream of Disneyland, it was really only Walt who believed in it. Lillian wanted nothing to do with it. His brother Roy didn't want anything to do with it. But Walt believed in a place where parents and children could have fun together. And his confidence convinced him that nothing was going to stand in his way from getting that park built in the orange groves of Southern California.
That's a good one. I think that's a great number one for our list, which is confidence in yourself and in your dream. And actually, I'm going to build on that for the number two item, which I'll toss in. And it's accepting failure and taking responsibility. So your book had a number of really interesting stories and quotes on this, which I think are good to apply to our own lives. So there were two quotes in particular that Walt himself said. One is, I think it's important to have a good hard failure when you're young. And the second was, you may not realize it when it happens, but a kick in the teeth may be the best thing in the world for you. And that's pretty interesting coming from someone that we see as an icon, someone who had the golden touch. But there were a lot of failures along the way for him. So one of the ones that you pointed out in the book that I really liked was how the estimate for Disneyland was originally at $4 million. And by the time the park opened, it was $17 million. So they weren't off just by a little rounding error or a few bucks, but by orders of magnitude, they were off. And that they had to make decisions because, do we want the plumbers to work on the water fountains or on the bathrooms? Because this place is going to open up and it is not done. And even when it got opened, or even when the park opened, people described it as a confusing mess, that there were traffic problems and just all kinds of issues. And still, it comes back to that confidence and accepting the failure, taking the responsibility and working on it, that it's not easy, that it takes some time to work through these things, and they don't always work well, but you continue to work on them and you make them better in degrees, and you go from something that's a confused mess to something that works like a well-oiled machine.
Absolutely. And that was really one of the inspirations for me in teaching the history of Disneyland class and then ultimately writing the book, The Wisdom of Walt. Today's generation of students, especially here in Southern California, who have grown up with Disneyland always being in their backyard. I mean, a lot of my students, they don't even remember the first time they went to Disneyland because they were so little and so young. They've always been going. And so as a result, they know very little about the park. They know almost nothing about Walt Disney, and they just assume that he fell out of bed successful, and he just spoke the word, and boom, Disneyland was there. And so we open up the class with a lecture on the Walt Disney of Disneyland, and they are shocked to find out that at one point his studio in Kansas City went bankrupt. They had no idea. And they're even more stunned to find out that more often than not, his animated features lost money rather than made money. And when it comes to the, you know, failures of opening day, Black Sunday, you know, which we just celebrated here in Southern California, July 17th of 1955, far more things went wrong than ever possibly could have gone right. But he believed in his dream. He didn't blame anyone. He took responsibility, and he kept moving forward.
And I think that's an especially important point these days when we live in a world of instant gratification and everything's an app you download in 14 seconds and it all is supposedly just works right away. But real life, especially when you dream big, just isn't that way.
No, it really isn't. And you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have challenges. Whatever your big dream is, if it were easy, someone else would have already done it by now. And what I always challenge people to do is go back to that storytelling element. Again, we love stories. It's why we read books. It's why we go to the movies. I believe it's why we keep going back again and again to Disney parks. Well, in order to have a story, they all require conflict. And too often, as soon as we get involved in conflict individually, we simply want to run in the opposite direction. Well, the bigger your dream or the bigger the story, the bigger the dragon. And so rather than running in the opposite direction, we simply have to pick up our sword with courage, with confidence, slay that dragon, and keep moving forward.
Very good. Yep, number two, accept failure, take responsibility, and as you say, keep moving forward. Good. So, okay, Jeff, number three, we're back over to you.
Okay. Well, I take inspiration not just from Walt Disney's life, but really, the park or the parks that he would build. And so, you know, one of the lessons is to build a berm around your dream. When you go into Disneyland, and we experience that more here in Southern California than folks say who go to, you know, Disney World in Central Florida, because there's just so much more land at Disney World than there is, say, at Disneyland. But, Walt, again, wanted to build an outdoor storytelling machine, and that really is what Disneyland is. But he was accustomed to telling those stories on sound stages, and so when it came to Disneyland, he came to realize, well, I'm not going to have complete and total control like I'm accustomed to having in a soundstage. And so he needed some sort of solution. And the solution came when they dredged out what we know of today as the Rivers of America. They took 350 tons of dirt and used it to build an earthen berm around the perimeter of the park. And Walt would go on to say, quote, "I don't want the public to see the world they live in while they are in Disneyland. I want them to feel as if they are in another world." Well, you ask any guest, why do you go to Disneyland? Why do you go to Disney World? Because it's special, because it's magical, because it's an escape. I feel as if I am in a different world. Well, it's because Walt built a berm around his dream. He kept all of the magic in and all of the distractions out. And so what I challenge the readers to do in The Wisdom of Walt, Leadership Lessons from the Happiest Place on Earth, is to think about their dream, whatever their goal is, and to build a berm around it. What is it that you need more of to make that dream a reality? What is it that you need less of? In other words, distractions. What is it that you need less of that need to be outside of your berm or away, as far away from your dream as possible? I think the real lesson here is focus. And when we focus, we're able to accomplish a lot more. And Walt certainly did that with Disneyland.
Interesting point. So I wouldn't necessarily have connected the concept of a berm, which as a Walt Disney World person, we don't really see that concept, like you said. But a way to focus your attention so you're not letting all those outside distractions creep in and take you away from what's really important.
Yeah, Steve Jobs would say, you know, focus is about saying no. And when Walt built the berm, he was saying no to the outside world and yes to everything that makes Disneyland so special and so magical and so memorable. And so whatever our dreams are, we need to have the courage to do the exact same thing. Build that berm around it and figure out, what do I need more of to make this happen, and what is it that I need less of? Remember, the dream for Disneyland was birthed on a park bench at Griffith Park in Los Angeles when Walt was taking his young daughters there in, you know, the mid to late 1940s. And I sort of have this picture of, well, what would Walt Disney look like on that same park bench in 2015? And I fear he probably would be distracted by an iPhone or an iPad or some other sort of electronic device. And so, you know, again, whatever our dream is, we need to have that ability to focus and to build a berm outside, or keep all of those outside distractions outside.
Yeah, good one. And I like the analogy. So build a berm around your dream. And actually, I'm going to build on that for the next item, which is going to be number four. And I'm going to say, remember the difference between a dream and a vision. And I think it was very interesting how you showed the difference between these two things. So you relayed the story about Walt sitting on the park bench in Griffith Park when his girls were on the merry-go-round or some ride like that. And he was saying, well, why do they only get to have the fun? Why isn't there a way or a place where we can have fun together? And so it wasn't a strategy session. It wasn't a guided tour of how to come up with goals and objectives. He was sitting on a park bench just kind of daydreaming and thinking. And that was important because it generated this idea that eventually became the parks. And it's okay to dream. It's okay just to sit back and think and connect things together without a defined objective. But then you talk about the importance of having the dream is good, but then you need to have a vision as well. It needs to turn into something more than just thinking about it. It needs to turn into plans. And that's something that I thought was very interesting and contrasted well in the book. So there was a story you shared also about how Walt died before Walt Disney World was built. And a story came from opening day where Mike Vance, who was a creative director, said, isn't it too bad, or someone said to him, isn't it too bad that Walt didn't live to see this? And in response, Mike Vance said, he did see it, and that's why it's here. Because he had a vision. It became more than a dream, just sitting back thinking about it, but it became plans and models and bulldozers, and it turned into something more than just sitting back. It became a reality because he took the time to turn that dream into a vision, something very specific on what he wanted to accomplish.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about, you know, just having this thought, this idea, almost sort of a you know, pie in the sky reality, if you will. My sense of it is that this idea or this thought just came back to Walt again and again and again and again and again, to the point where he simply couldn't let it go. He had to pursue it. And once he began to pursue it, he took that thought, he took that idea, he took that dream, and then began to cast a vision. And as he did that vision casting, the vision or the dream got more and more specific with each passing conversation. One of my favorite stories in the book is the so-called lost weekend. And what happened was, as he got more and more serious, he realized he was going to need some level of financing to help make this dream a reality. And so he was getting ready to send Rory back to New York to talk to the bankers on the East Coast. And he realized, you know, there's need more than just a dream. They have to actually see something tangible, and unfortunately dreams don't have collateral. And so, you know, he called up what was then a former employee, a fellow by the name of Herb Ryman, on a Saturday morning, and Herb got over there in about half an hour, and he began to share with him, hey, you know, we're working on this, you know, idea for an amusement park. And Herb goes, well, what are you going to call it? And he goes, well, we're going to call it Disneyland. And Herb's like, well, that's as good a name as any, I guess. And then they said, well, you know, Roy's getting ready to go to New York to help us get financing, and, you know, we need a map. And Herb is like, well, great, show me this map. I'm curious. And they're like, no, you don't understand. We don't have a map. That's why you're here. We want you to draw one. And Herb looked at Walt and said, you're out of your mind. I can't do that in a weekend. It would embarrass you, and it would embarrass me. No way, Walt. And then Walt said the key words. He said, Herbie, this is my dream. If I stay here with you, would you help me do it? And so in the course of about 40 hours, throughout the rest of that weekend, the two of them worked on taking what had been a thought, what had been an idea, what had been a dream, what was becoming a vision, and actually putting details down on paper. And if you go back and look at the map today, which happens to be one of the most valuable pieces of artwork in the entire Disney archives, you see parts of Disneyland and Disney World that are very, very familiar and very, very similar. And then you see other parts that never came to fruition. And the point of all of this is dreams evolve, and they evolve as you go through that vision casting process. But again, you have to trust that dream and trust that process and know that you're going to end up with something very, very, very special if you keep moving forward and take it to the very end.
Mm. I think that piece of artwork is one of the most famous in Disney history. I believe it's the one that's got the hot air balloon, because it sort of distracts you where the details aren't. But still, if you look at the overall layout of the park, it's pretty familiar. So that weekend really laid the groundwork for what we all see and visit today.
It really did, and it sort of makes you curious of, you know, wow, they really knew what Walt wanted to do, and then at the same time, you're kind of like, man, I wish they had finished this, or, you know, I wish this had actually become reality. And so it's fun to look at, and it's fun to kind of wonder, you know, what could have been, or, you know, as opposed to what actually is.
Yeah, and amazing to think that piece of art, and really that blueprint for how these parks would be built, came together in a weekend on paper, but probably had been percolating, as you said, for years ahead of time.
Yeah, and I think what few people appreciate some 60 years later is, again, nothing like that had been done anywhere in the world. And the amusement park operators that existed in the country at that time, when they heard what Walt was doing, and more specifically how he envisioned doing it, they all told him he was nuts. They all told him he didn't know what he was talking about. Most people expected the park would be closed in less than a year. And yet, you know, Walt, again, just kept moving, you know, forward. And it's fun here in Southern California. I did a Grandparents Day presentation back in April and was honored. I had a couple of folks in attendance who were actually there on opening day, July 17th, 1955. And I asked them, what was it like? What do you remember? And to a person, they said, we had never seen anything like it anywhere. And you knew instantly that this was different and this was special.
Hmm. Wow, that's great that you had people who were actually there. Very interesting. Okay, good. So that was number four, the difference between a dream and a vision. So Jeff, we're back over to you for number five.
Well, one of my favorite fun features at any Disney park is the way in which the Imagineers use forced perspective. It's actually known as, quote unquote, the architecture of reassurance. Walt wanted the parks to have a storybook element. Again, he was a storyteller, and so he wanted the guests to literally step into the story and feel as if they had gone through the silver screen and were stepping into a storybook. And of course, all of that started with his love for trains. And, you know, the train here at Disneyland is built to a 5'8" scale. Well, if Walt had had his way, the entire park would have been built to a 5'8" scale. But the Imagineers and, more importantly, the engineers had to sit Walt down and say, look, that's great for your train, but that's not very realistic for real-world shops that, you know, real-sized people are going to be walking in and out of, you know, tens of thousands of people every single day. And so the compromise that they made was that the first floor of those shops would be built on 90% to 100% scale, and then if there was a second floor, it would be built to a 3/4 scale, and then the top floor is built to a half scale. And so that forced perspective results in everything at Disneyland or Disney World appears taller or bigger than it actually is. And so as a result, we all feel a little taller. We get that sense of reassurance every time we step into a Disney park. And it's a reminder for me that life really is all about perspective. I share this with students all the time. Life is not what happens to you. Life is how you perceive and how you react and how you respond to what happens to you. And so every time we go into Disneyland, whether you're on Main Street looking at the castle, whatever the case may be, forced perspective is in play. It's tricking you into seeing things exactly what the way that Walt and the Disney artists want you to see them. And so I think the challenge for all of us dreamers out there is when it comes to our dreams, we need to look at life from that perspective, meaning forced perspective. And what I tell the readers in the book is that ground floor of 90% to 100%, that's gratitude. That's thankfulness for everything that we already have and everything that we've already accomplished. And then the middle floor, the 3/4 floor, that's whatever the next is. That's whatever your next goal, your next achievement, your next accomplishment might be. And then the top floor or the smallest floor, those are your obstacles. Those are the challenges. Those are the naysayers. Those are the difficulties. And of course, what we find in today's generation is that too often we usually build our life with a ground floor of negativity. And so I challenge the reader to invert that, recognizing that criticism is a poor contractor for building an awesome life.
Mm. Wow, great points. And I like the idea of using this concept that Disney employed architecturally, a forced perspective, to consider your own perspective and how you choose to view the things that happen to you. And your point about negativity is a good one. I think we're inundated by that, and it's so easy to be anonymous and negative in the world of online social media. We're just immersed in it constantly, and it doesn't have to be that way.
No, it doesn't. And I think part of the reason why we go to Disneyland or Disney World is to sort of escape from all of that. And the main reason why I wrote the book is I believe, I'm just crazy enough and naive enough, I believe we can live every single day, whether it's in our jobs, in our life, with our family, we can live every single day like it's a day at Disneyland. We simply need to know what to look for and figure out how to apply what's at play inside the parks and bring that home into our everyday life.
Mm, great idea. I like it. Good. Okay. Number five was remember forced perspective and watch your own is how I would summarize that. And we're back over to me for number six, which is the last item. I feel like there's a lot more territory we could cover. But for number six, I'm going to share a couple stories that you had in the book, which I had never heard before. And it's about how, at least what I took away from it, is it's okay to be inspired by others, but it's okay to add your own touch too. So you relayed a story about how when Walt lived in Kansas City, Missouri, he saw not just one amusement park, but actually two. There was Fairmount Park, and then there was Electric Park, which at the time was one of the largest amusement parks in America. And you tell a story about how there were many design elements in Electric Park in Kansas City that very interestingly look like what we see at Disney parks today. So there were thrill rides, there was an emphasis on music, there were fireworks each evening, there was a train that surrounded the park. And all of these things Walt saw and probably borrowed and took them into his own park. But he didn't just go and rebuild Electric Park 2.0. He was inspired by those things, but he definitely added his own touch in some of the ways that we talked about before, with storytelling and detail and building it in a way that had never been done before, on a level of quality and in storytelling that had never been done before. So one of the points I'll mention here for number six is that it's okay to be inspired by others, but make sure you add your own touch too.
Absolutely. And, you know, I work in higher education, and you want to be careful about, you know, repeating the ideas of others. We call plagiarism here at CBU the unoriginal sin, if you will. And, you know, what we see with Walt is a lot of brand differentiation. And what I mean by that is he didn't build the first amusement park. He was inspired by World's Fairs. In fact, his father, Elias, had worked at the Chicago World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition, in 1893. And one of the points I make in the book is, you know, Walt didn't necessarily care for Elias's stern, strict, and humorless personality. And I think it was those stories from the World's Fair that for what were sort of an escape from a personality that he didn't really care for otherwise. And that's really where I believe the seeds for Walt one day building an amusement park, even if it didn't happen until he was 53, I think those seeds got planted somewhere in his childhood. And then, of course, they get a little deeper when he sees those two amusement parks in Kansas City. So, yeah, we're going to be inspired by other people. We're going to be inspired by other things. And yet, at the same time, each and every one of us is unique and can bring our own idea, our own thoughts, and hopefully our own dreams to the table and make a difference as a result.
Excellent. You know, Jeff, I feel like there are probably 12 other things that we could mention that you have in the book, probably a lot more that we can apply to our own lives, but I try to keep it to a top six list. So even though I want to keep on going, I'm going to stop here and recap our top six Disney lessons you can apply to your own life. So number one, be confident in yourself and in your dream. Number two, accept failure and take responsibility. Number three, build a berm around your dream. Number four, remember the difference between a dream and a vision. Number five, remember forced perspective so that you watch your own perspective. And number six, it's okay to be inspired by others, but be sure to add your own touch too. And these six and many more can be found in your book, which I have to say I've enjoyed reading very much. And I think I said before, it seems like on each page there was something new or interesting that I had not yet seen before. And that's something I really appreciated about your work. Congratulations on it.
Oh, thank you, Herb. I really, really appreciate that positive feedback. I'm very humbled by the response that the book has received so far.
Great. So, Jeff, if people are interested in learning more about you and your book and what you're up to, how can they do that?
Sure. Well, first of all, we have a website, thewisdomofwalt.com, and the book is available there. It's also available on Amazon, both as a hard copy and as a Kindle ebook. I would like the listeners to know that every hard copy, regardless of whether you order it from the website, again, thewisdomofwalt.com, or through Amazon, I personally sign every single hard copy, because I believe that's what Walt would do. This project is a passion of mine. It's the realization of a dream for me, and so I want to make it as personal and connect with the readers as close as possible. And I know that, you know, we're coming up on the Christmas season, and it really does make a wonderful and a beautiful Christmas gift for any Disney fan, any Disney friend, or any Disney family member.
I would agree with that. And I've got to say that this book is not filled with corporate speak and all sorts of jargon that may be good for a Fortune 500 CEO, but what does that mean for me? I was able to connect very personally with the lessons, especially because they were framed as they came from Walt Disney or from his company's experience. So I found it a very practical book in addition to being a very entertaining one.
Well, thank you, Herb. And, you know, you talked about, you know, bringing your own touch. There are dozens of Disney business books out there, and many of them are very, very, very good. In fact, I use several of them as source material for my book. And yet at the same time, I really wanted to do something that I think is a little different, a little special, and a little unique. Most significantly, I wanted to tell as many stories as possible. If Walt wanted to be remembered as a storyteller, if he built Disneyland for the purpose of telling stories, then I wanted to connect with the readers by telling stories from Walt's life, stories from Disneyland or Disney World, and even stories from my own life. And hopefully, by doing that, connect with each reader's story so that we can all be as awesome as Walt Disney and we can all be as awesome as Disneyland or Disney World.
Excellent. So, Jeff, thank you for taking the time to realize your dream in writing and publishing that book, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Herb. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, we've made it through the list of the top 6 Disney lessons you can apply to your life, but our conversation doesn't have to be over. I would love to hear what you think about the list. Maybe you've got something different or something you'd like to add. You can do that by checking out the show notes page at worldofwalt.com/45. It's a page that works very well on smartphones, tablets, and desktops. Leave your comments in the comments section and let me know what you're thinking. I'd also like to thank everyone who's been in touch with me, like Elaine, who wrote, "Love the World of Walt website. I enjoy reading your site all the time." Thanks, Elaine. I would love to hear from you, too. It's easy to get in contact with me to let me know what you think about today's podcast, or just stop by and say hi. Drop an email to me at info@worldofwalt.com, a voicemail message at 407-391-5023. Leave an online voicemail message at worldofwalt.com/voicemail, or follow me on social media, facebook.com/worldofwalt and pinterest.com/worldofwalt. If you liked today's podcast, I would love it if you would rate and review it on iTunes. It's easy to get instructions on how to do just that at worldofwalt.com/iTunes. I'd also like to invite you to enter a very special contest that's open to people who listen to the podcast and visit the show notes page. Head over to that show notes page again at worldofwalt.com/45, and there you can enter to win a $100 Disney gift card. It's easy to enter by following the simple directions on the page, and it's my way of saying thanks for listening. To wrap things up today, I'd like to give you a heartfelt thank you for spending some of your very valuable time with me today. I'd also like to thank everyone who visits the worldofwalt.com site, where you can find interesting Disney articles and chat with other folks who like Disney in the forums and in the comments sections. By visiting here and by checking out the site, you allow me to share the fun of Disney with you. And that's pretty cool. Thank you so much for being a part of it. So until next time, my friend, may God bless you.
So there's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow, shining at the end of every day. There's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow, just a dream.